TFM.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, is that an RCL type 1 matrix field you're holding there, or is that an RCL type 2?
Actually, Chris, this is a 3, it's very rare. You don't see them very often, and only used for very specific matrices for Cardassian encryption, and specifically for the Obsidian Order. And so, therefore, very, very dangerous. So be careful.
That's what I thought. It sounds like you stole that prototype technology from an Obsidian Order lab.
I can neither confirm nor deny whether that happened.
All right. Well, let's just drink our Ractogenos and keep quiet about it just to be safe.
Oh, Chris, I can't have another Ractogeno this time of night. I'll be up forever.
All right, everyone. We are going to continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Deep Space Nine with episode 7 of season 1. This is Dax. And here's a quick rundown of the story. Aliens with an uncanny knowledge of the station and its systems attempt to abduct Jadzia and take her back to Klaestron 4 to stand trial. Only it's Dax they really want, and the crimes were committed 30 years earlier by Curzon. When her crewmates successfully stop the kidnappers from leaving Bajoran space, the accuser, Elon Tandro, is forced to make his case for extradition. During the ensuing hearing, presided over by Bajoran Grouchmaster Els Renora, Sisko must do what Jadzia refuses to do, fight for her life. In the end, he succeeds with the help of Odo, who discovers that the real killer was not Curzon, because at the time of the murder, he was in the bed with the victim's wife, Matthew. My goodness, what a twist to the story.
Yes, it sounds like an episode of Clue.
Right. Well, let's go ahead and start the discussion. I had considered having Els Renora moderate our discussion today, but I just thought, you know, she might not set the right mood for us. So we'll just take it ourselves. And I guess start with the central part of the story, which is the question of how intertwined a symbiont and host become.
Yeah, Chris, I think this is a really interesting part of this show. Obviously, like you mentioned before, this is the 7th episode of the season, so it is very early, and we don't know, you know, much about the Trill at this point in the first place. And so this episode is going to be kind of our first foray into really understanding how they work. And I appreciate that the way it's handled is very nuanced, and it creates a conundrum to which I don't really know if the episode can truly answer, because in some ways it's not just a biological question. It's a metaphysical question. It's this question is something that I think is, you know, almost even beyond kind of science when it comes to two beings like this being merged. Who is what and what is where, and how does it all connect together, and what does that mean? You know, it's a really hard thing, I think, to be able to discuss in the first place. And so, but the fact, I think, that they actually start digging into this is really interesting. And obviously, it's a very Star Trek type of question to be asking. Who is responsible for what? How much of a symbiont is the current host and how much is it the symbiont, and where does that all come down in the idea of, you know, responsibility? And so I really appreciate this because I've seen this episode so many times now, and I'm still always left coming away from it with the difficulty of how difficult it is to answer this question.
Yeah. It's a very difficult question to answer, and really the episode doesn't answer the question, mm-hmm. which sets the DS9 tone right here early in the series. But yeah, I've always just found this one an interesting one to watch and to ponder the question being asked about who is responsible for the, in a situation where you have the host and symbiont and they merge and they can't be separated, but the symbiont does live on eventually and can be passed on to another host. You know, how those memories and actions in particular are associated with mm-hmm. with the physical being that everyone else comes into contact with, I guess is the real issue here, because for the people like Tondro or Sisko or anyone who has to interact with Dax, they can only interact with the Trill host, and the symbiont just remains mysterious. And I don't, it could be an interesting discussion because I don't have any firm view of how I feel mm-hmm. about this, other than I think that it would be really wrong for Jadzia's life to be taken because of something that the symbiont inside her did mm-hmm. while it was
right.
inside Curzon as a host.
Yeah.
And now whether the symbiont is responsible for something is a separate question. I just couldn't, if I were in the position of being a judge in this, I just couldn't find Jadzia to be responsible for what Curzon did.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I do think that the question of, you know, who is responsible is a very fascinating one. And I tend to agree with you because I don't think that you could actually hold Jadzia and therefore even the symbiont at that point responsible, because a part of who that being was at the time is gone. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you do end up with this thing where if somebody was given a symbiont, they shouldn't have been, and can they be held for liable for the actions of the previous host? It's a really difficult conversation, but I don't think that you should be able to do that because you are merging with a whole other person, and therefore mm-hmm. you are changing the being in enough of a sense that you can't take the life of the new host to pay for the mistakes of the previous host. And mm-hmm. I think what is, and the reason I say that too, is because we do know it's not perfect, and we'll find out later on, but this is our first foray into this, that the Symbiosis Commission spends an enormous amount of time trying to make sure that they only give a symbiont to a worthy host so that this is not going to be an issue, right? Because, and in all honesty, you know, this would be the perfect crime. And so I think because that's the case, you can't hold a current host liable for the actions of a previous host, because mm-hmm. in many ways, yes, that previous host is gone, and the symbiont is even changed by the joining with the new host. They're not the same because they have had added memories to them. So to me, that's where I kind of I come down on that. But on the more, like, I guess physical, psychological, medical, metaphysical question, I think that's just much more difficult to be able to answer as to exactly, you know, how all that works between the two. And so, yeah, I mean, it's hard because it's even hard to understand how to talk about it because they're so intertwined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like in this case, Sisko mentions at one point that maybe Curzon liked women a little more than he should have, something along those lines. And I feel like Curzon Dax, it was maybe more Curzon than the symbiont that found himself in bed with Anino Tondra at this time. I don't know. I'm just based on what we hear in the episode and knowing Jadzia's personality over the course of the series, and you get to see how she, as the host, seems to have dominance over the symbiont in terms of her approach to life and the actions.
Right.
Otherwise, every Dax host, every incarnation of Dax would be very similar if the symbiont were largely in control, right? And so that's one reason I feel that it was Curzon who was responsible for the actions of the symbiont at the time,
Jadzia. Right. Especially the indiscretion, of course, that we discuss about, you know, him having an affair with a married woman. And so I 100% agree with you on that.
And then there's the other issue of, in our real world, we have a statute of limitations on crimes, certain crimes. I mean, there can be, you know, new evidence can come to light or something. But we've built into our societies this concept that a person is not perpetually in danger of being prosecuted for something that they've done. And so in this case, this happened 30 years earlier. So I would, on Claystron 4, maybe they don't have this idea of a statute of limitations, but if I'm just absorbing this story as a human and thinking about it as social commentary, and how do I feel about Jadzia being potentially put on trial for this, I feel that the statute of limitations would have run out on a case like this.
Right.
And then when you consider that we're dealing with a symbiont that is no longer in the same body as it was at the time, then most certainly the idea of a statute of limitations should apply here. And so in my own thinking, it certainly does.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think what you said there is something that comes to play in the episode, right? What we learn is that this son is just more dedicated to try and find somebody to blame for his lost father's death than anything else. So there is that motivation. I also think, too, you know, Chris, one of the things that this episode does a great job of, and it's really in retrospect when you're rewatching the episode after you've seen the series, this is an episode, I think, which helps us see how Jadzia herself is still struggling in some ways with how to integrate every host and the way that she portrays the whole thing. I think some people might find it maybe wooden or maybe just not enough, but I think what it helps do in the long run is show the way in which this character is having to begin to integrate everything. And as she moves forward, she's going to become more of who she is as Jadzia Dax instead of just Jadzia. And so as those things merge, she becomes more of who we kind of think of her to be later on. But that's not going to be here because, you know, she's only been this quote-unquote person now for a very short time. I can't remember exactly how long, but I know it's not been that long. I think that's pretty incredibly played. And again, it could seem like something to which they're not quite sure what to do, but actually I think that just works. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you see it on her face, even at the beginning when they show up and they call her name. And
right.
She obviously remembers. She knows who they are. She knows why they're there. She remembers what Curzon did. And then throughout, when she refuses to speak up and defend herself, and she has these looks on her face throughout the process of the hearing, I think it's played quite well. And it is clear that, yeah, she's having trouble adjusting to, maybe I shouldn't say she's having trouble. Maybe she's not having trouble. Maybe it's just the natural process, but it is new to her and she is adjusting to being a host here and having to deal with these memories, because I think that would be very difficult to deal with. Even if you knew it was coming and you've been trained for it, it would still be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells Sisko that, "I feel the shame of Curzon's indiscretions. And when one of my kind stumbles, it is a mistake that's there forever."
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think it's there forever in your memory, but I think that as you adjust to being a host and as you grow into being a joined trill, you start to learn how to compartmentalize that stuff and deal with it. The same way we do as humans, as we become adults, we're better at dealing with things than we were when we were teenagers, right?
And I also think, too, again, this comes back to the fact that this is still very new for her. So, and this, what happened, and since, you know, Curzon was the last host of hers, I think that this is the thing that really creates her feelings of immediacy for this. Even though it happened a long time ago for Curzon, she's integrating all these emotions and feelings and memories. And again, Curzon's would be at the forefront, I think, with the symbiont. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, this does make it more difficult for her. And I think it's just really well played. And it's one more thing where, you know, we talk about how the writers of Deep Space Nine utilize these things to their advantage. I think that this is an episode to which really gets utilized as we move forward, as they try to continue to figure out what this character is going to be like, because they obviously don't have it figured out here. And what's great is that neither does Terry Farrell as the actress, and neither does the audience. And so it actually ends up becoming a benefit to them as they move forward rather than a detriment. And that's, I mean, you know, that's the felicity of filmmaking, right? Where those little types of things happens, especially in a show where if you're a good writer, you find a way to pick up on that and you use it later on instead of it becoming that thing where like, oh man, I just wish we had changed this. No, you utilize what you did and you make what could be considered just lemons, you make lemonade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it definitely benefits the story as well, because the fact that Terry Farrell isn't yet sure who the character of Jadzia Dax is allows her to very naturally portray, I think, the situation that Jadzia is finding herself in here. So let's talk about Sisko a little bit, because another thing that stands out to me here is that Sisko, of course, wants to support Curzon because that's his old friend. And he knew Curzon as Dax, so he's familiar with the symbiont, and I think he wants to defend there. But as the story goes on, I feel more and more that he really is defending Jadzia as a woman, individual person, separate from the symbiont. The idea, and not even because she is an officer under him, but the idea that a 28-year-old woman could have her life taken for something that she didn't even do is something that doesn't sit well with him. And he really works hard to come up with a defense for that.
Mm-hmm. No, I could not agree with you more. I think that this is another place where the episode allows the integration of the characters in their relationships to move forward, especially, you know, this is... you know, Facebook status. It's complicated with the relationship between Cisco and Dax because, you know, he was a he then, and now she's a she, and therefore it creates this real interesting dichotomy of like, how do I find a way to make this switch? But also, I think because of the fact that everything that Curzon was is still there, creates this special bond. And I think that it's just really special the way in which, like you said, I think it starts as his relationship with Curzon, but it moves to his relationship with Tenzia. And I think this also says something just about Cisco as a person, because he's willing to go to bat for her, but we'll also see him, as we move forward in the series, be willing to go to bat for all of his officers, right? You know, I think of this actually applies to the Tosk episode, right? Captive Pursuit. He gets on, quote unquote, you know, I'm doing dink-dink quotes. He gets on O'Brien because he has to, but he actually supported O'Brien personally. And so I think there's just something that we're seeing here about Cisco as a commander. He's really dedicated to his officers. And it's not just as a commander, I think, because these people become friends, you know, and we're kind of starting that process here. And so I really appreciate the way it's done.
Yeah, and I think Cisco is very open-minded to the possibilities, because he says that he prefers that no crime go unpunished, and he asks Tondro, in defending Jadzia, how can you be so sure that the symbiote was the criminal influence? What if it were the Curzon host that was responsible? Which is an interesting statement for him to make, given the importance of Curzon to him as he was growing and making and becoming a man and rising up through the ranks of Starfleet. Curzon was very important to him, and I think it's very difficult for him to think that Curzon could be responsible for such crimes, but yet he is raising that as a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the beautiful thing is that he does not believe it to be possible, but he's also willing to entertain the idea that that there could have been a possibility this happened, especially I think after he learned that, you know, there was an affair going on. Mm-hmm. And he did know that Curzon was capable of that type of behavior.
Right.
And so one of the beauties here is that there's just a lot of nuance happening in this episode. There's a lot of nuance going on with Dax and the relationship between the symbiote and the host, the ideas of who was responsible, the relationships between Cisco and Dax, the ideas of all of these things, I think, and even just the performances that we're getting. And then on top of that, you know what I think is so great is that we also have another movement in the relationship between Kira and Cisco. Mm-hmm. She, and not only with that, but it's her relationship with then Dax and the crew of Deep Space Nine. She is becoming more a part of this crew in a way that I don't know if she thought she would at this point. Mm-hmm. And what's great about that is it's just such a fun moment too. When she's like, and that just really annoys us, you know,
right.
It's so Kira, but it's her putting everything into, what she can do to help save this person who is becoming a friend to her as well as a colleague. And I think that's another great thing about this episode, because it allows for a lot of good movement in the relationships between these characters. Mm-hmm. Even if they're only in, you know, 20% of the scenes.
Yeah. That moment. I love that moment. It is so Kira. And speaking of Kira and Bajor here, this is another case where early in the season, they're using the setting very well to differentiate the series from The Next Generation. because the lack of an extradition treaty sets this all in motion in the first place. It would have been difficult to do this story on The Next Generation. You would have to have the characters be on another planet somewhere and be abducted in that case. You would just have to change the setting. But here it works very well as a story set on the station, thanks to the technicality of them being in Bajoran space. And so this is technically a Bajoran station, just happens to be administered by Starfleet. And speaking of the station itself, then, we can talk about the setting a little bit. Did you find it interesting that they decided to hold the hearing in Quarks? Because it doesn't seem like the kind of place where you would normally hold a hearing, but they say one reason they did that was because, I mean, of course they can save some money by not having to build another set, but also within the context of the story, we're not very far in yet from the Cardassians leaving and trashing the station, and so a lot of the station would still not be usable at this point, and they needed to find a place to do it, they meaning the actual crew of the station, and why not use Quarks?
Yeah, I think that this is well done. It's funny in many ways, just because, you know, behind the scenes, they blew a bunch of their budget on the premiere episode. And so they are trying to find ways anyway to be able to save money in any episodes that they can. And so this is absolutely a way to do that. But I also appreciate that they do this in a way that allows us to play with the characters of Odo and Quark to give them some fun scenes together. And Odo is trying to appeal to the fact that, you know, Quark likes Dax and he knows that and it's not really working. So then he appeals to what you can get every Ferengi with, which is his pocketbook. And so, you know, it's a great utilization and a great way of writing yourself out of a problem when it comes to budget, but making it fun and allowing us again to have little character moments that kind of continue our understanding of who these characters are. And I think it works great. And so, and it does kind of make for this more momentous feel, right? Because you're in this space, right? And you've transformed this space that's supposed to be meant for fun into this place where, yeah, we're putting on trial a woman who was barely alive when this was supposed to have happened. And so,
would not have been born yet, actually.
Exactly. It's just this crazy thing. And so I think it just really works. They do a really good job with that.
Were you disappointed that when the arbiter ruled in Jadzia's favor, no one yelled, "Dabo!"
I mean, that would have been great, you know? it just seems like she had won, right? And did everybody get a round of drinks after that as well?
I don't know. I think Quark would still charge at this point. Probably. Later on, maybe not. Another interesting thing that I came across in preparing for this is that part of the premise of this episode is very similar to a short story that was written by Jorge Luis Borges in 1944. It's called Theme of the Traitor and the Hero. Now, the short story was later, it was turned into a film called The Spider's Stratagem by Bernardo Bertolucci. So it was an Italian film. But I'm really into short stories, science fiction short stories, so I prefer to look at it from that angle. And the elements in this short story that are kind of similar is that the story is about an Irish leader named Fergus Kilpatrick. Actually, Borges, in the beginning of the story, he's sharing that he has this idea for a story. And then to tell it to us, he quickly assigns character names and locations and things to it. And then what happens is that later on, there's a descendant of Kilpatrick named Ryan, and he's preparing a biography. And in the process, he uncovers that Kilpatrick was actually killed by a group of conspirators after they discovered that they had been betrayed to the British authorities by him. And the oldest conspirator, who's named Nolan, agreed to make his death a memorable event in Irish history and make him a hero. And then Ryan, as he's preparing this biography, he decides to leave the myth intact. So it's not an exact parallel to what happened here, but it does feel close enough that I do wonder if there was inspiration there from maybe not the short story, but maybe the film that was made from the short story. And the part at the end in particular where Anino is talking to Jadzia and she tells her that she wants her to promise to just live, you know, to live her life. And the fact at the end that they've kept this myth intact about what really happened, I think that that parallels it in an interesting way. And so it was just something that I hadn't thought of before in relation to this episode. And given how many times we've discussed Dax, the episode Dax, I thought it would be something fun to bring up.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that we kind of were talking about a little bit on The Artificial Tango was the idea of the kind of Shakespearean nature of the show and much of the, even the way that the characters speak, kind of coming back a little bit in that season. And I think, you know, the beauty of you bringing that up is that that story, this story, I think what they do and help us understand is that we may have the broad brushstrokes of history, right? And I'm not saying that it's not true what we know, but that there is always more detail and there's probably always more backstory and there's probably a lot more intrigue than we're aware of, right? And this is the type of story that helps us remember that. And that, too, there are going to be, and there will be, some heroes that we may discover were less than heroic. And so, and yet, the question then becomes, is the mythology, and I guess the lie, more important mm-hmm. than the truth? And that's a really interesting conundrum. And of course, here, they make the decision that the lie and what came from that lie is more important. But, you know, we never get a chance to follow up with it. But in mm-hmm. all honesty, most things built on lies tend to crumble. So, you know, the decision they make here is understandable, but it's also something to which I know historically doesn't tend to last very long.
Right. Yeah. So, and I also thought that the fact that Ilan Tondro he's uncovered this thing about his father and he's been obsessed with it. Now he's uncovered some new information mm-hmm. and then he's going to follow that and try to maybe set the record straight, especially for himself and get justice for himself. And then in the end, they decide to let it go. It was very interesting parallel mm-hmm. there.
Well, and at that point too, you know, you don't, as the son who's been doing this to kind of find a way to build up his father, mm-hmm. the last yeah. thing he wants to do is to then destroy that. So
right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And if anyone's interested in reading the short story or listening to it and you like Star Trek actors reading, you can actually get this in an audiobook from Audible. It's a collection of Borges's short stories called Labyrinths, and it's read by Dominique Keating, which is quite interesting performances that he does there of the short stories. And it's actually quite a short story too. It's about an 8-minute read. So anyway, check that out if you're interested in it. And I guess while we're talking about the Tondro family, Matthew, one other thing to bring up is the fact that the actors we have here, Fiona O'Flanagan and Gregory Itzen, they both have other characters in Star Trek that we're familiar with. For you and me, doing our 20th anniversary rewatch of Enterprise on Warp 5, we've seen Flanagan because she is Valar in the first season episode, Fallen Hero. And anyone who's watched The Next Generation will also know her as Juliana Tainer, Dr. Soong's wife, in the seventh season episode, Inheritance.
Yeah, I love when they do this for Star Trek, and they bring back these actors and actresses. I think it's fantastic. And part of that, too, is just that they're people who can play so many different types of emotions. And they become the role that they're in. And so then when you see them in that role, you buy it, right? And that just shows to the way in which I think the casting directors for all of the Star Trek shows really just knew what they were doing. You know, when they found somebody that they could trust, they would bring them back, and it makes sense to why you would do that. And so I love that that's the case. And, you know, I think they found two great actors here, and there's no reason not to bring them back.
Yeah, and for Flanagan, this was her first appearance. So her appearance on TNG, it's in season 7, so it's actually after this episode. And then, you know, some time passes. Watching her here was interesting for me because we watched her as Valar more recently, you and I did. And watching her here and then thinking about Valar and realizing that, yeah, it is the same actress. She really brings a different personality and a different flair to Valar.
Right.
And then Itzen, he also was on Enterprise. He's the Vulcan Captain Sopek in Shadows of Pajim in season 1. And then he's Admiral Black in In a Mirror Darkly part 2 in season 4. And then elsewhere in DS9, he's in the fun episode Who Mourns for Morn, where he helps Morn pull off the Lesepian Mother's Day heist as Hain. And then he's also on Voyager. He is the Denali Dr. Dysek in Critical Care in the seventh season of that show. So he is around for quite a while in Star Trek.
Yeah, I think, you know, each one of those places, he kind of falls into the role and you almost don't even recognize him and just does a great job. So I think they give everything they need to the roles, and that's all you can ask, especially from people who are guesting on a show like this. You know, another thing I love, Chris, that's great about this episode is that it is the first mention of Ractigino in Star Trek. And I love that because I love a good Ractigino. And I do have to say, I've still never understood why StarTrek.com does not sell the Ractigino mugs from Deep Space Nine. Because I feel like they would make a ton of money, especially those ones that they had in the Replimat, the blue kind of wide bottom mugs. Those are the perfect size for coffee in the morning. And give them to people. Plus, you know, you have all the other types of Ractigino mugs that they have there on Deep Space Nine, from the ones you get on the Defiant to the ones that you get in Quark's Bar, Cisco use. I mean, so there's many styles. So if you're listening, StarTrek.com, which you should be, I don't know why you wouldn't be, give us the Ractigino mugs, you cowards.
It is surprising, given everything that they do make and sell, right, that's not there yet. And yeah, it's great that this is the first mention of Ractigino because it becomes such a frequently mentioned drink in Star Trek. Of course, in Deep Space Nine, it's the drink of the station, it seems, for so many people. But we've even gotten mentions of it later on after DS9. So it really becomes part of Star Trek. And one thing I do wonder, though, Matthew, an authentic Ractigino on Kronos, do you think it's made with Targ's milk?
It could. I think that's what, like, just puts it over the edge for a Klingon, you know, is when it's made with fresh Targ milk. Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I tend to drink oat milk in coffee because it's
maybe
much better
maybe that's
for my stomach.
That's what they call a ractogino latte, Chris, when you have it with the Targ's milk.
I see. Because I was picturing the looks I would get on Kronos if I walked in and I ordered a ractogino with oat milk and all the warriors would be looking at me and snickering, you know.
Exactly.
Can't stomach the Targ milk, can you?
Yep.
Yeah. All right, Matthew. Well, I think we've gotten to the end of this one. So what are your final thoughts and what's your rating for Dax?
Yeah, I think that this is a good episode that really does a great job of giving us the character that is one of the most interesting characters in Star Trek, right? I think and they do a great job of starting to explore what it means to be this character. And I think this episode gives us a lot of other good character moments as well. It creates different relationships and begins to create more bonds between people here on the station, which is fantastic. And so I'm going to give this 4 out of 5 Bajoran gavels, which are strangely similar to gavels that we see on Kronos.
They are, right? Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know, I've shared pretty much all my thoughts here. The episode is one that I continue to watch and really think about. And like I said, I don't have a definitive view other than I don't think that you can hold someone responsible for the actions of another person in the way that would be done here. But the episode, the story does a good job of raising complexities that make it very hard for you to just come to a quick decision. And the fact that we can still discuss it in this way after having watched it so many times for 30 years, it speaks to the strength of the episode. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give it 8 fertility idols from Raiders of the Lost Ark, which you can spot in Dax's quarters if
you look
closely. Yeah. Oh, and one other thing I wanted to mention, which we didn't bring up, is that this is the final Star Trek script written by DC Fontana.
Mm.
And of course, fans of Star Trek and those who know the original series and the history of the franchise know well DC Fontana's importance to Star Trek and getting it to where it gave us everything we have today. So wanted to mention that. Everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Dax. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So if you're joining for the first time, please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. It is a closed group just for listeners. And the way to find it is to type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or just type the whole name, the Babel Conference, if it doesn't come right on up. And you'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. And if you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the orb, and that'll come to Matthew and me by email. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. And thank you to everyone who has rated and reviewed us so far. Now, Matthew, when you're not busy traveling around with Odo investigating 30-year-old crimes, where can people find you?
Well, you could find me all over the place on social media. You'll want to search the name MattRushing02, Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero, or the places I am most active. You can also, of course, find me here on the network in the 602 Club, where we're talking about every other fandom outside Star Trek that we love. It's a great place to hang out, so I hope you'll join us. You can also find us doing Warp 5. Chris and I are doing the 20th anniversary rewatch of Enterprise. You can also find us on Saddle Up. Plus, we talk about Strange New Worlds. Literary Treks with Casey. I'm talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. And the Artificial Tango is going on right now because we are celebrating Star Trek Picard Season 3. And Chris and I just are... unable to control our excitement for what's going on that show right now. So we hope you'll join us over there. And then you can also find me on the Nerd Party Network. I have two shows. One is called Owlpost with Drea Kaufman. We talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And then the other is Aggressive Negotiations. And I'm talking with John Mills about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out what the best Ractigino on the station can be had, where can people find you?
Well, yeah, I'm trying them all, and I'll let you know soon which one is my favorite and where to get it. I think you might need to run and get it in that special cork mug. But when I'm not doing that, you can find me elsewhere on the network. As you mentioned, you and I do all of those shows together, and Larry Nemechek and I do The Ready Room from time to time. I do a lot of other episodes. You can find me in the back catalog on all kinds of shows. And if you'd like to chat with me in social media, you can find me everywhere under the username C Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Twitter's where I'm most active. I'm also on Mastodon on the Trekkies.social instance as C Brian Jones. So feel free to drop me a line in social media, talk about Star Trek, Japan, whatever you want to talk about. And I'll look forward to catching up with you there. If you would like to help us keep this show and our other rewatches and everything else that we're doing here on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without the support of those of you who are helping us out there. So thank you so much to everyone. And if you're not yet a patron of the network, we hope you'll become one. So thank you, everyone, very much for your support. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time where we're going to be welcoming a new passenger to the station.
Well, Chris, I am excited about that. And I'm glad that everybody joined us this week. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.